Freedom Fiends. Welcome back to the show. This is Lou Sanderfine, and I am sitting in for Mr. Michael Dean, who is addressing the Harvard Psychology Department, giving the keynote address on why cats are superior to humans and why dominance doesn't work in that factor. I am joined tonight with my good buddy, Bill Bubert. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great, Lou, and it's an honor to be on the show with you on the Fiends, with Michael when he's here, and with you when he's not.
Well, thank you very much. And it was really nice to meet you at Porkfest.
That was tremendous. I really enjoyed that. The Fiends family picnic that we had and the various speeches we attended together, the various talks we had, the big gay dance party, all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The whole thing was just awesome. For those that don't know, Bill is a retired Army officer. He is the founder and editor-in-chief at ZeroGov.com, the president of the Lysander Spooner Foundation, and a world-renowned pole dancer.
That leaves some pregnant pauses in the audience, I think.
Should we elaborate or just let them wonder?
No, go ahead and elaborate if you want.
Okay. I found Bill at the big gay dance party at Porkfest. And there he was with his shirt open, and for a 54-year-old man.
That's right.
Quite a physique. Swinging from the pole, doing the, what is that, the clutch flag?
It's called a modified clutch flag. If people put modified clutch flag in the start page or whatever they use to search the internet, they can find some video footage of what that is. It's based on a convict conditioning program that I do.
Well, I have to say that you're doing it quite well, and somebody who has messed with gymnastics back in high school, it does take a fair amount of athleticism, to say the least, and I almost put a dollar in your shorts.
Well, I appreciate that, because I'd rather have a dollar put on my shorts when I'm pole dancing instead of having you flip me onto the ground, maul me, stand up, and then throw a dollar on my supine body.
I'm not a traffic cop. You don't have to worry about that. So, yeah, Porkfest was a great experience. This is kind of my first time back on the show since then. I got back, Monday night. And by the time I got unpacked, I had like about half an hour, and I was supposed to Skype in for a couple minutes and just recap some of the experiences of while I was there. So, yeah, nice long trip home, and then come on here and talk for a couple minutes. And I was only supposed to stay on for like 20, 30 minutes. I wound up doing the whole show and then going to work the next morning. Oh, it was beautiful.
You know, we're all doing the same thing, because once you and I are complete with this broadcast, I think we both have to go to work this morning.
Yeah, well, I'll do my laundry and then be at work at like 8 o'clock, something like that. But anyway, yeah, Porkfest was a great experience. And you gave a couple really good presentations. I missed one of them because I was on a panel. But you covered Police State USSA.
I did that on Friday. And then on Thursday, I did a speech on the connection between abolitionists and ancient Stoicism. Wednesday, I talked about ZeroGov, which was about my evolution and why the Constitution sucks. And then we did the debate, of course, Lou, which the Fiends sponsored and Michael Dean authored, that abortion clinic that we had on Friday. And then that's when you and I went to the big gay dance party afterwards, along with my wife. And then Saturday morning, I did a four-hour seminar on irregular warfare history and practice.
Okay, I caught all but the Thursday one because I was cooking dinner.
Sure.
The Thursday when I was on the panel, Thursday afternoon, the abortion, I missed that. I was intentionally on the other side of the campground cooking dinner. So,
and a great dinner it was, by the way. I just wanted to give a shout out to Lou for not only being an accomplished liberty activist, an accomplished show host, an accomplished minister without portfolio, doing whatever he does to make a living, but he's also an outstanding chef.
Well, thank you very much, kind sir. Now, the trip there and the trip back was really good. On the way back, I stopped with my buddy Tom. We overnighted in Rochester, New York, and then we went to the northwestern corner of New York State and I met up with one of my very first Facebook friends. He was probably in the first 10 people that I'd met on Facebook, or definitely the top 20, but I got a chance to finally meet him in real life for the first time. And real nice guy. He goes over, are you familiar with Africa Youth Peace Call?
I am.
Okay. He's gone over there twice and taught classes on finance, economics, entrepreneurship, all sorts of neat stuff. And I was able to do probably about a 30-minute interview with him, which hopefully I'll be able to release in the next month or so. But yeah, very good experience. And the travel was really neat because I could have flown to New Hampshire, but then again, I couldn't have brought all my kitchen stuff. I probably would have had to ship it or something. But going through Vermont and the route that we took on in Vermont, it straddled the state line of New Hampshire and Vermont. So I'm pretty sure it was the same stuff on the New Hampshire side. And then also the upstate New York. But it was a very beautiful drive. The scenery through Vermont, New Hampshire, and upstate New York was just really, really amazing. And something I wanted to talk about a little bit was the joys of travel. And you've done a fair amount of traveling, Bill.
I have indeed. You know, the only problem I have with New England is that to riff off of what Gandhi said about Christians, it's filled with New Englanders, and that makes me despaired.
Oh, I can't argue with that because I'm sorry, but they do talk a little bit funny. And if you go to Massachusetts, the vast majority of them are stark raving communists. And
oh, they're barking mad collectivists. I mean, look at it this way: for 8 years, starting in 1775, the country had its violent divorce proceedings from the United Kingdom. And what do they adopt themselves as being in these states in the northeastern portion of the U.S.? New England, because I guess they liked old England so much they wanted to cling to a part of it.
Yeah, I just can't see that. I mean, the whole purpose of getting a divorce is to completely separate.
Indeed.
And, you know, going off on a side note here, a lot of people are just absolutely opposed to secession, but they just celebrated Secession Day last Friday.
You know, I refer to it as Dependence Day because I agree with you in spirit, Lou, that originally that should be what July 4th represents, but not wanting to bore the audience again with the history portion of 250 years ago and what happened and then getting burdened with the Constitution. In the end, what's happened is that we've taken all those tyrants that were abroad and simply installed local tyrants here.
Yeah, what was that line from the movie The Patriot? Would you trade 1,000 or one tyrant 3,000 miles away for 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away?
Thank you. That's a great paraphrase. Exactly.
Yeah, and this notion of the perpetual union, well, if you can't leave, it's not a union, it's captivity.
It's interesting because the Articles of Confederation is followed by, in its official title, as the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. But when you examine the Articles of Confederation compared to the Constitution, it was a far more freebooting document as far as individuated freedom was concerned and left a very weak, extremely sclerotic central government in place. But of course, that's one reason why it had to be eliminated during that political coup in 1787 to 1789 to form the Constitution. And as I've said before, the Constitution is probably one of the most devilishly clever documents to make a slave people think they are free.
Oh, definitely. Now, let's get out the tyranny for a little bit and go back to the joys of travel. Where are some of the places that in the U.S. that you really like to go, scenery, activities, things like that?
Gosh, what a great question, Lou, and you're right. Let's visit Libpar for a while. I love the Inland West. I went to school at Humboldt State University on the Northern California coast, and if you went to Berkeley and you said, Berkeley's far too right-wing and oppressive for me, and you had to go to another university, you would have gone to mine. Mine was Humboldt State, but one could call it the V.I. Lenin Institute. But surprisingly enough, In this beautiful Northern California area, there were two Austrian economists hiding in the cellar up there, and I learned at their knee while I was there, getting my political economy degree. But the area was wonderful. I mean, if you look at pictures of Humboldt County, those in your audience who haven't been there, go online, not only is it probably one of the marijuana production capitals of North America, making some of the finest sensimilla that you can have here, that short of going to Hawaii to get some. It's wooded, it's alpine, it's got a really temperate climate. The ocean's right there. I remember going to my daughter's alternative high school graduation, my eldest daughter, and we're having the graduation, and there's only 50 people in her class. Over the cliffside where we're having the graduation, you can hear like 100 sea lions serenading us during the graduation ceremony.
Well, so that was awful nice of them.
Oh, it was wonderful. But it's a great junction of ocean, mountains, and forest, and alpine regions. I mean, for instance, I had a hunting cabin back in Petrolia, which is an area near the coast in Humboldt County. And when you go there, if you close your eyes and you click your ruby slippers, you would swear that you're in Wales, England, from the topography and the way things are. So But I like the Inland West, which is I've lived from Idaho to Arizona and a few places in between. I love Southern Utah. I think Southern Utah probably has one of the most concentrated densities, some of the most gorgeous topography in the lower 48 that there is. I've lived in Hawaii. I've lived in a number of different places around the world, to include Japan, Germany, parts of Southeast Asia, and visited a lot more than that. It's hard to put my finger on my favorite place, but if we're isolating ourselves to consideration about North America, the Inland West really has my heart.
Okay, I've never been to Northern California, and I've heard a lot of the stuff that you've just said and a whole lot more. As a child, I did go to Portland, Oregon to meet my grandparents out there. They lived out there for a number of years before moving down to coastal Georgia in the southeastern part of that tax farm. I remember going up to Mount Hood. Well, anyway, I remember going up to Mount Hood and seeing the... Okay, more Freedom Fiends when we come back, and we'll try and get back Bill Buport. Worms!
Listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. This is Lou Sander Fien, sitting in for Mr. Michael Dean, and I'm joined by Bill Buport. Michael Dean is explaining to the Harvard Psychology Department how cats turn off the power strip and shut down your computer and Skype and everything else in the middle of the radio show. But anyway, before we went to break, we were talking about the joys of travel, and Bill was talking about his time in the Pacific Northwest, inland, Northern California, and I was talking about Portland, Oregon. As a kid, I went there to visit my grandparents, and I was pretty young. It was the 70s, so probably, 7, 8, 9 years old, something like that. But I remember going up to Mount Hood, and I think we were there in July, and it was just amazing that there was snow on the mountaintops and people were skiing in July, but they were wearing short pants.
It's beautiful. And yeah. We're a family of skiers, and we've skied in Canada and Germany and in Idaho and parts of Colorado, and my favorite remains Northern Idaho at Schweitzer Mountain. That remains my favorite ski resort because it's a great nexus of challenging slopes, how inexpensive it is, accessibility and just sheer beauty.
And yes, yeah, the skiing is really neat. I wish I'd have stuck with it. I went tubing this year up in Traverse City, Michigan. So it's not really mountains. It's more like hills, or probably like a landfill that was covered up and grass planted and ski lifts put on it. But still, it was pretty neat. And so, yeah, and good times with that. But
I just find the East Coast and the Eastern states and the Midwest to be geographically impoverished.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
It's flat, it's dull, and it's filled with collectivists.
Yeah. One of the things I really remember about Portland was those big giant redwood trees and how roads were built around the redwood trees. So you'd have this divider in the road and you got this redwood sticking out, and it's just, you know, really wow. And as a kid, there was a picture of me trying to put my arm around it. I'm like, wow, I can't wait till I'm a grown-up and I'm big enough to wrap my arms around this thing.
And if you did that, you'd have to be Shrek.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would never grow big enough to do that.
Well, let's hope not, because that would be rather large.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because could you imagine the trouble trying to get clothing if you're that size?
It would be. Yeah. But then again, when you look at the increase in obesity of America, I'm surprised that muumuus and pup tents aren't more popular as outwear attire.
Oh, yeah. Omar the Tent Maker.
Indeed.
You mentioned Germany, and we were both in Garmisch, Germany.
Yes, we were.
I was there in the summer of 98. When were you there?
I was there in 2000 and just visiting. So I wasn't there, you know, stationed there, because I was actually stationed in Heidelberg and Stuttgart. But I got to go to Garmisch for some conferences. And wow, it's just Germany is just an amazing country geographically. It's also an amazing country intellectually, because I just wonder how impoverished we'd be as in imagination, moral adventuring, and philosophy if the Germans hadn't been around.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed my time over there, and my time in Garmisch, I spent about 5 weeks there, something like that. But just give an explanation of Garmisch and paint a picture for the listeners of how beautiful that city is. And a lot of the southern Bavarian cities, because it basically the whole area is tourist area. But just paint that picture for them, Bill.
Sure. Bavaria is it's not only mountainous alpine country that would remind somebody of the Swiss Alps and places like that, but it's very rural, and it has roots that go back almost 3,000 years of civilization. I would say German civilization, but Germany didn't become a country until 1870. Before 1870, Germany had something of a cultural identity, but like France, it was fractured, fissured, devolved, and it was a bunch of people who had a lot in common, but didn't share a political unity of any type, which of course I think is a good thing. The food is just wonderful, because you go to Bavaria, and unlike northern Germany and western Germany, the cuisine's different, much like you find in America. The architecture there is just so interesting, so unique. There's a lot of mountain lodge, ski lodge architecture. The streets are rather confined by American standards, but then again, you have the Autobahns.
All righty. More German travels, cuisine, architecture, and Worms when we come back right after this.
Hey, this is Squiskar Squigelps from Death Clocks, and you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios, and I guess it says Worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech as hate speech, guns and weed, by sheep or sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $5 for 10 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
And welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. Traveling the world without passports, because we don't need it. And that would be just a little glimpse of lib pair. You know, 100 years ago, passports were largely unheard of, and people in capital could cross borders relatively easily. And immigration, also known as moving, was not such a big deal. Bill, are you still there?
I'm right here.
Okay. We were talking about Germany, and you were painting a little picture of Bavaria, and I spent most of my time in Bavaria, and I really loved it. To go into a little bit of description of the city of Garmisch, and it's actually Garmisch-Partenkirchen, it's surrounded by mountains, like on 3.9 sides, it seems like.
Yeah.
And you have the Zugspitz, which is the highest point in the Bavarian Alps, and is a very charming little community, and the architecture is the mountain lodge, as you explained. There's this nice little river that goes right through the downtown area, and if you're walking down the main street to get to downtown, you'll follow that, and you got the little wooden bridges. But the rapids there are just absolutely beautiful, and the water is like crystal clear with just a greenish tint to it. And it's just really amazing.
It's wonderful because the Germans, as a people and as a community, tend to take really good care of their environment, not to the extent of being the kind of envirous Nazis that you and I are accustomed to here in the United States and other parts of Europe. But they seem to take a genuine interest in the welfare of that for hunting, for sports, for fishing, and those kind of things. Like you said, you know, why is the architecture built the way it is? Because of high snowfall, they'll have steep roofs on a lot of their buildings. There aren't a lot of tall buildings in Garmisch, and it's a really charming little burg that belies the total population that's there, because it seems like a small town.
Yeah, and they still have the Olympic ski runs and a couple other things up from the, I believe it was the 1936 Olympics that were based out of Munich, but they spread all the way down to Garmisch.
Yep.
And in the two towns of Garmisch and Partenkirchen, they combined so that they would be big enough to host a part of it. Yeah, I got a chance to see that when I was there in 98.
It's just beautiful. Anybody who hasn't been to Germany, well, as a matter of fact, anybody who hasn't been to Europe, and to take it even further, if you haven't left these United States, by the way, if you don't have a passport, you're wrong. If you haven't left these United States and spent a couple weeks somewhere else to experience what it's like, you'd be amazed on your return to discover that all the news you've been watching, no matter what your political or philosophical persuasion, they are wrong about the rest of the world.
Oh, definitely. Going back to the cleanliness that you're talking about, over there you don't see litter like you do here. And if you're in a big city like Frankfurt or Munich, I think more Frankfurt than Munich, though, you'll see litter on the side of the road. But down in Bavaria specifically, you don't see quite as much of it, and just is nothing to see an old German lady on a Saturday morning out at 7 or 8 a.m. sweeping up her sidewalk in front of her place.
Well, as a matter of fact, I saw that in both Stuttgart and Heidelberg when we lived on the economy, because we actually lived in Germany, and it was amazing to see that sort of community spirit that was voluntary.
Yeah, Yeah. And I don't even know that it was community spirit. It might have been individual spirit, just everybody was doing it independently, collectively. Because I mean, it is part of the culture there.
It's hard for me to ever use the word collectively in a sentence without being negative, so I'm going to I'll defer from that.
Okay. independent in group action.
Okay. I'll go with that.
All right. I don't want to have to twist your arm here or audio board you over the interwebs. But and for those that don't know, when I got out from my first enlistment, I went back to Germany as a civilian. I spent about a year and a half over there, and I had a little Joe job on base so that I could get my ID card, ration card, and commissary privileges, all that neat stuff. But I did a little bit of travel while I was over there, and I was, let's see now, when I got out, I was 22, I think. Yeah. No, I was still 21, because, yeah, I was 21, and I turned 22 after being over there for a couple months. For the young people that aren't really interested in going to college and jumping right onto the hamster wheel and getting involved in the rat race, if you have the means and a little bit of basic knowledge and can get over to Europe, I would advise backpacking.
You know what? It would change their life for the better if they took a month, 6 months, 1 year, when you've really got no attachments, whether it's familial or, well, go with your girlfriend or maybe your wife, or you have no children and you're in that position to experience the world out of a backpack and on your feet and just the whole wide open space of Europe, Africa, wherever you decide to go. It'll change your life forever.
And it's pretty easy to find a place to stay, particularly for the young folks, because you got the youth hostels and everything. But I'm sure that you experienced this, Bill, when you and your wife were over there. You meet a German family, you know, while you're traveling or something like that, and they invite you to come stay at their house for the weekend or for a month or something like that, and they actually think nothing of it.
But absolutely.
Now, I was on a flight over there, and I can't remember which trip it was, but I met this old lady from Berlin, and she wrote down her phone number on the plane, gave it to me, and says, hey, if you make it up to Berlin, give me a call. You know, come stay at my place. And I wasn't able to make it up there, but, you know.
It's nice for people to offer that, and they'll offer it to people they don't really know too well, you know, and they're taking a chance, they're assuming risk. But you know, if more people, you know, in America and the world just said, why don't I go out of my way to be neighborly and to be kind and to show that persuasion, cooperation, and nonviolence is in my self-interest, that if I treat people well, maybe they'll treat me well.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, because they don't just walk up to a stranger and say, hey, you want to come stay at my place for the weekend? Yeah, it's not quite that trusting and free, but after having a conversation with a little while, you can generally gauge another person's demeanor and their personality and what makes them operate, and you can pretty much tell fairly early on what type of person you're dealing with, especially on a transatlantic flight. You have enough time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, once again, I would say if you have a couple months or a year, you know, shoot on over there. It's easy to find places to stay. You got cheap motels. They call them Gasthauses there. Or Gasthaus or Rasthaus, I can't remember. But anyway, one of the things I used to do was I would go down to the train station on like Saturday morning, and I would hop on a train, and I didn't know much about Germany. I was brand new there, only a couple months there. And I would look at the train schedule, and I would look for a town with the coolest sounding name. And I'd get on there, and I'd go up there, and sometimes I had a blast. It was just a beautiful place. But sometimes it was, you know, a one-horse town, literally. They had one horse in a brewery.
It just proves out that one of the most valuable things that we will ever have in our life is that bundle of experiences and not the material possessions that we have.
Right. Right. No. Oh, and you do know that there's a town in Germany called Worms, right? It's spelled Worms, but it's pronounced Worms.
I am quite aware of that.
Yeah, Freiheit Fiends. But yeah, I mean, a lot of neat things to see. It's not hard to do. And I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but I can't recommend it enough. If somebody has the time, or even just traveling across the U.S., this little experience that I just had with Porkfest, driving from the failed state project in Michigan over to New Hampshire, it was a very beautiful drive, very scenic.
You know, I'd like to call you on this failed state project. I like the way you're describing that, and I do know why. But what is really surprising to me is that Detroit, and I learned this from Karen DeCoster on Lou Rockwell, who does a pretty good diary of what's going on there. Wherever vacuums assume themselves in Detroit, people are getting together on a voluntary community basis and filling the gaps and taking care of each other.
Well, right. They're filling in the failures of the state. And
indeed.
And Detroit is really, really doing a lot of really neat stuff. And sometime we're going to have to sit down and just hammer this out. It's amazing. These people aren't libertarians or anarchists, but they're acting like they are because they're going outside of the system.
Yes.
But I think Ben and Cindy have just the right idea with their mobile home and driving around from place to place with a dog, solving mysteries and seeing, you know, the different parts of the country. You know, Ben talked about the different places that they're going to be going. They have a wedding somewhere in August and all these different things. And then in the winter down in the south and on the Gulf of Mexico. And it's just really nice to be able to go out and do that.
I think Ben's hit just the right median with that because he's not doing the Jack Kerouac, Dharma bums, living out of dumpsters kind of travel. And he's not doing the kind of rich aristocratic travel. He's got a real nice median aggregate that he's achieved where he and Cindy are really comfortable and they're having a great time and they don't have any roots. You know, when I sold my house and now I live in a rental and I've liquidated all my U.S. real estate, I can't tell you the relief, both financial and philosophical, I have by taking that burden off my shoulders.
Oh, definitely, because the way that governments are, they'll seize anything, especially property and real estate.
Absolutely. But by the way, for those in your audience who aren't aware, Ben Stone is a bad Quaker. He has his own podcast. I highly recommend that you seek it out and listen to Ben. I met Ben for the first time along with Lou when I was at Porkfest. Not only does Ben have a sonorous and mellifluous voice, but he's probably one of the clearest liberty thinkers I've encountered in a long time, if not my entire life.
Oh, yeah. Ben is great. I met him last year at our first annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, and he's just such a down-to-earth guy and gentle and definitely a great sense of humor. He's a blast to be around, and I had the privilege of doing a couple shows with him from Porkfest the first Sunday afternoon and then the last Sunday afternoon. But, yeah, great times. We'll be back right after these messages and this trip to the market. Worms!
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. I steal your labor by force through taxation.
My job is to spy on you and keep you from hearing things like the Freedom Fiends. I especially do not want you to torrent
Freedom Fiends episodes to keep them drone-proof. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives.
Freedom Fiends. Welcome back. This is Lusander Fiend, the titanium meerkat, and I'm joined by Bill Bupert. Bill, what's your wrestling animal name?
The silver snow leopard.
The silver snow leopard.
That's it.
Okay. In the last segment, we were talking about really neat places to travel. Let's switch over to some places that we don't want to travel. or at least not right now. What in the happy Halloween is going on over in Iraq and Syria and all that other stuff?
Well, it doesn't mean that you don't want to travel there. There's some, Robert Pelton puts out some world's most dangerous places travel logs. And as you and I both know, going to dangerous places isn't necessarily dangerous if you take the right precautions. You know, we could die crossing the road here in America or at the hands of a cop or whatever the case may be. You know, places I would rather be in Iraq than visit D.C.
I can't really argue with that too much, but I haven't been to Iraq, so.
Yeah.
I have.
Well,
been.
Iraq, Afghanistan, whatever. Whatever neo-imperialist mud pit you want to come up with.
So what's going on over there with ISIS and all this other stuff? And before we do that, I want to invoke a Mises quote. Each new intervention is an attempt to deal with the unintended consequences of the previous interventions. Go, Bill, go.
Mises is just amazing. Now, he's hard. He's turgid to read. You know, reading Mises' Human Action is like trying to get through T.E. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom. It's a turgid, difficult read, but well worth it for what you get at the end of the journey. There is no doubt in my mind that the crises that we see populate in the Middle East have deep historical roots rooted in Western intervention. What we have with ISIS is a Sunni organization that is trying to bridge a gap through support from Shia in Iran and also Shia elements in Syria, because what they'd like to do is have almost a geopolitical bridge between Syria, Iraq, and Iran.
Okay. So essentially what you're saying is they're basically trying to form the Shia crescent that people were warning about.
Well, they are, and we should... I don't think any of us should be surprised at this, because put yourself in their sandals or boots or shoes and ask yourself, if you had been invaded since 1526 repeatedly by Western countries, wouldn't you look to your left and right and ask people, are you with me or are you with them? And those people who say they're with you, no matter how rabid and violent and silly they may be, you may want to join forces with them, because the enemy of your enemy is your friend for convenience.
Okay. You've read a fair number of Tom Clancy books, right?
Well, I stopped after the third one because they were so raw, raw American military, so raw American intervention that I had to have an air sickness bag with me when I continued reading.
Oh, yeah. The statism is thick with that one.
Oh, my gosh.
There was one book. It's the second one of the Jack Ryan presidency. And the Iranian Secret Service takes out Saddam Hussein. And then shortly thereafter, you have the reunification of Iraq and Iran, or the unification, I should say, creating that Shia crescent. And what's really amazing is if you look at a lot of the different things that Clancy had in there, I'm putting on my min status dunce cap, but... He should have been the national security advisor, because he wrote so many things that wound up happening. I'm not sure if other people got the ideas from him or what, but he wrote all these things and he was pretty much dead right on a lot of it.
I'm looking forward to when no national security advisor is needed.
Worms to that. More Freedom Fiends, second hour coming up.
Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Freedom Fiends. So, Bill, do you remember when we were told that regime change in Iraq would bring stability to the country and the region?
Well, we've been told that since 1898 as far as American adventurism overseas.
Okay, and what's the track record on that?
The track record is a big fat zero for liberty and a big fat 100% for Leviathan.
Definitely. Yeah. So let's get back to this ISIS in the Levant. Who is ISIS? What exactly is ISIS for people that aren't really up on it and people that have been hearing everything from it's a bunch of crazy religious fanatics to it's the New World Order lizard people bringing in their one world government? What's up with ISIS?
Well, here's the thing. I don't speak Arabic. I'm conversant in the politics, but I don't speak Arabic. Because of that, it's very difficult for people in the West to really get a good idea of what ISIS exactly is. But what it is, what we're being told, and this is the information we have available, it's the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. It's a jihadist group that's active in Iraq and Syria. It was formed in April 2013, and apparently it grew out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was called AQI by the West. It's been disavowed by al-Qaeda, interestingly enough, since then. Now, the final S in the acronym ISIS, I-S-I-S, it stems from the Arabic word al-Sham, and that can mean the Levant, Syria, or even Damascus, or even the Caliphate, or even a global jihad. No one really knows, and whoever ISIS is, they keep themselves cloaked in I wouldn't say secrecy, but they're very nebulous about what they're trying to achieve. I think what's going to happen is that whatever the Western reaction is, if it is not neutrality, is going to lead to unintended consequences, much like American involvement in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Horn of Africa in the last 12 years, which has not reduced Iraqi or Muslim resistance to Western intervention, but stiffened the spine of that resistance and caused so many new resistance movements to Western intervention to arise in its place. Because it's like they say, it's very difficult to keep up on maiming and killing women and children and not filling the ranks of the resistance with male members who seek revenge.
Oh, definitely. It's kind of the foreign policy of the bombings will stop when morale improves.
Exactly. You know, this organization apparently is led, and I say apparently, much like I say when we talk about the dead in America, I'll say acknowledged dead. I'm going off what I see on the news. I don't have a special crystal ball or an underground network that gives me better information than everybody in your audience has. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He is the leader of this organization, and I think that either he or some of his lieutenants were even former residents of some of the detention facilities that the U.S. and the West had. So one would wonder, much like Bobby Sands and the IRA getting elected to the British Parliament in the 1980s while he was imprisoned by the British, I wonder how much of that vibe and riff is going on here as far as energizing these resistance movements.
I find it amazing that somebody would wind up in Gitmo or Abu Ghraib or any of these other sites and that would solidify their resolve or create new terrorists. Yeah, I'm being completely facetious and sarcastic when I say that.
Certainly, you know, and we got to be careful with this term terror because they're saying, well, ISIS is a terrorist organization. let's go back to, and we've had this discussion before, Lou, and I've had it with Michael. Terrorism means politically motivated violence against noncombatants and innocents. Absent terrorism, governments, Western and Eastern, could not conduct their daily business. Cops could not conduct their daily business. What we see here, for good or for bad, is a nascent resistance organization that's numbered in the thousands, who's trying to throw off the yoke of what they perceive to be Western interventionism or Western occupation or whatever the case may be. I think this thing is going to take off. I think that it's going to become bigger and bigger. It's going to metastasize like a cancer throughout the entire Levant. I think we could very well see that, since this is Bush's fourth term, that this entire assault since 9/11/2001 on the Middle East is remapping, restructuring, and revolutionizing what that map is going to look like in the future. And it isn't going to benefit the West in the way that the West envisioned when they started the invasions in the first place.
Okay. I'm looking at an article from a link that you sent me. This is in Jane's, and it says that foreign fighters in Syria is at an alarming level. And I believe they say that about 85% of the foreign fighters in Syria end up with the ISIL.
As a matter of fact, that was Professor Peter Neumann of King's College London who made that estimate of 80% of Western fighters in Syria have joined the group.
Okay. And let's go with something else. These foreign fighters that go back and forth, they're commonly labeled as jihadists. What about them being more mercenary than jihadists?
It's very possible. You know, it's hard to divine. For instance, look at any revolutionary complex, any kind of organization that sets itself up and declares that we are going to use military and political means, much like Sinn Féin and the IRA did. And what we have here is that you have these Muslim organizations, which are both Shia, Sunni, and one of the other 90 subsects of Islam. Islam is bifurcated and complicated by schisms, much like Western Catholicism and Western Protestantism, where among the Protestants you have Methodists, you have Lutherans, you have Baptists, you have all these different sects whose interpretation of this root book of Abraham, that the religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam follow, say, no, we are the ones with the correct vision. And they harness this vision to rifles in the Middle East. They harness it to these revolutionary movements. So I think it's, from the West, it's really convenient for them to say, well, they're all mercenaries. Is that true? I don't know. What you have to ask yourself is whether mercenary or, let's say, they're indigenous resistance forces, what is the impact of whether they are mercenary or indigenous on their ability to fight against what they're trying to do or establish the state that they're trying to establish or to achieve the goals that they had set out to do? We can look at the Germans who were brought over by George Washington in the first American Revolution, who, absent von Steuben putting the Continental Army together the way that he did in a very Prussian fashion, maybe that UK yoke would not have been thrown off if von Steuben, the mercenary, had not professionalized the Continental Army at the time. So I think it's all problematic.
Yeah. I find that a lot of times darn near all the time, when people give reasons for doing something, there's the reason that they give, and then there's the real reason that they do it.
Indeed. You know, everybody has an agenda. Now, is the agenda self-interested? Well, I would hope it's self-interested, because I think that altruism is probably one of the worst evils that we suffer in this world, because no one knows what's better for Lou, Bill, or members of your audience or members of their family than they do. I mean, I would never be so presumptuous as to say, hey, Lou, you need to do this and you should do this, because, of course, I is the only word that should be in front of should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the religion seems like a convenient excuse for doing a lot of different things. If we go back to the secession of the southern states from the northern states, one of the reasons given, I believe it was South Carolina, was about slavery and specifically the Fugitive Slave Act. But there are many arguments that was just a convenient excuse given to divorce from Lincoln and get off the United States tax farm.
Certainly, because they were tax cattle. And secession and revolution is the rule and not the exception in Western history, and I suspect I'm less well-schooled in Eastern history.
Okay. You know, I saw an interesting graphic on FaceBeef not too long ago. It was a quote, I believe it was from a woman. She was like a civil rights person. And she said that most Muslims look at the radicals in the same way that Christians look at the Westboro Baptists.
You know, that could be the case. But remember, the Westboro Baptists aren't hunted down and don't suffer this kind of centuries-old intervention against their lifestyle that we see visited on Muslims in the Middle East. You know, it's like I've said before, since 1526, no Muslim nation has invaded any Christian nation. Since 1526, Christian nations, Western nations, have invaded dozens of Muslim nations. So if that's the case, what kind of rhythm and what kind of evolutionary process in the peoples who are occupied does that create as far as their resistance to that intervention?
Yeah, for some reason, it's just don't like being invaded for some reason. I don't know. I can't understand it.
And I've said
freedom bombs.
Yeah, and I've said it before on Michael's show. Please, your audience should read Robert Pape's two books, Dying to Win and Cutting the Fuse, where he talks about suicide bombers and homicide bombers. And he discovered in his very exhaustive and comprehensive study that 85% plus of all suicide homicide bombers do that because they are striking a blow against occupiers and they are indigenous in their strike against the occupation.
Okay. In about 1 minute's time, can you tell how this is going to impact the Americans other than the looting and the loss of liberty and just perpetuating the war machine?
You know, I think everything that America's been doing since 1898, since it finished exterminating most of the Aboriginal tribes in the United States. When I say exterminate, I mean exterminating their ability to craft their own destinies. And it may not exterminate them in body, but it certainly exterminated the American Aboriginals in spirit. This is a money laundering operation for the military-industrial complex, and it will continue apace until the economy collapses.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the military-industrial complex. There was another link that I found that talks about how Iraq has received a number of Su-25 fighters from Russia, but they also ordered a bunch of American fighters.
It's very curious that they would do that. You know, apparently the Iranian military has been trying to keep their limping F-4 Phantoms airborne now for the last 2 decades, and they've been pretty ingenious in trying to do that. Having an inventory of both Russian and American aircraft, wow, what a problem.
More Freedom Fiends coming up after this trip to the market.
Bombs!
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty Projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiends message worldwide to as many liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. This is Lusander Fiend, and I'm joined by Bill Bupert, the pole dancer extraordinaire. I've been looking at a couple of articles in regards to ISIS and what's going on in Iraq, and this one here is in Forbes, and it talks about how the unrest in Iraq is having an impact on oil production. I guess a number of oil companies have abandoned refineries or mostly abandoned, and oil production in Iraq is dropping down quite a bit, and that seems to benefit, guess who? Saudi Arabia.
Well, it does, but let's also remember that when ISIS captured Mosul in June of 14, they had cash and assets worth an estimated $900 million. Afterwards, that rose to approximately $2 billion as a result of their own control of oil fields in both Iraq and Syria. But I want to make a couple points before we close this segment, if I may, about ISIS. ISIS can go in a number of different directions, and there's two directions we can examine. They can go the way of the Taliban in Afghanistan because they're going to have to govern. And if they govern and they don't do it well, they are going to lose the mass base that supports them. If they assume the kind of governance stance that Hezbollah and Hamas does, then they are going to increase their mass base, and they'll probably get some semblance of legitimacy that simply doesn't come from the barrel of a gun. But who knows what's going to happen, Lou? You know, all bets are off, and I would urge your audience to please dismiss Fox News and the Collectivist News Network as great outlets and go to Al Jazeera if you really want to see what's going on in the Middle East.
Something else that I saw an article on was, I guess, two tankers have loaded up with oil that was produced in the Kurdish region, and it sounds like the folks in Baghdad have a little bit of a sour stomach over that, if you will.
Well, they certainly do. You know, the Kurds who were in the north of Iraq at the and their north and the Kurds' northern borders with Turkey, a NATO ally in the west. The Kurds have always been pressing for their own independence. They've always been pressing for being a distinct ethnic minority in Iraq, and they're pretty jealous about that. Fortunately, they live in mountainous terrain, much like the Afghans and the Chechens, and they have a very firm military and rifleman culture. And I think that the Kurds will be able to dictate what they want to do from their own geopolitical haven that they have. And the Kurds are also very savvy businessmen.
Okay. I remember after Desert Storm, there was Operation Provide Comfort, and a lot of U.S. troops were up in northern Iraq providing security for the Kurdish region because after the slap on the wrist or spanking, if you will, Saddam Hussein decided he had to regain power, and the only way for him to do that would be to go out and kill people until morale improved or fear.
That sounds like the way Western intervention works.
If Iraq split back into three countries again, because that's what it was before the maps were redrawn before T, how do you see the relationship between the three, I guess, different groups that make up Iraq today? Do you see them becoming peaceful? Do you see the rivalries keeping up? Or do you just see, you know, I don't know. What do you see? Tell us, Bill.
You know, I'm of two minds on that, Lou. I think that we should assume Swiss neutrality in the Middle East to include a complete derailment of any connection we have to Israel, Saudi Arabia, and all those other countries in the political sphere, and only purchase stuff from them. Hopefully only private people purchasing from other private people, because I think that all this Western intervention and all this Western nonsense with 90-degree and angular map lines and things, it's created this vicious, violent brew that is the Middle East today. Of course, some of it can be blamed on the Indigs there who've been fighting each other for thousands of years, but it certainly hasn't been helped by the Western intervention that's occurred there, where they start to take sides. And of course, once they do take sides, it becomes obvious that they're going to arm one side. Another polar element on planet Earth, whether it's the Chinese, the Indians, or the Russians, will arm somebody else. And then the conflict begins anew. It just makes things worse.
Instant turmoil. Just add government intervention.
Amen, brother.
Oh, it's a mess. We'll be back with more Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market. Say worms, Bill.
Worms.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support only a phone call away 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like the Fiends host, because we know how to do it right. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. This is Lusander Fien with Bill Bubert, and we are not a bunch of socialists.
Indeed, we are not.
But we do know who is. There's a interesting clip that I came across on YouTube a while back, and it was Milton Friedman recounting a story. And Kyle, if you could go ahead and roll that tape, we sure appreciate it.
Hayek loved mountains. He said they breathed freedom. But he saw socialist ideals and the planned economy as threats to freedom. And so he organized a conference at a formerly fashionable hotel on the top of Mont Pelerin, Pilgrim Mountain.
Well, what happened in 1947 was that Hayek at last brought off a great dream, which was to assemble 36, mostly economists, some historians, a few journalists, a handful of what he regarded as survivors, good eggs, good intellectuals, who understood the market economy and the whole of the case.
One of the delegates was a young economist from Chicago, Milton Friedman.
And the point of the meeting was very clear. Hayek and others felt that the world was turning toward planning, and that somehow we had to develop an intellectual current that would offset that movement.
They met downstairs in the cocktail bar. The debates were passionate. At one point, Hayek's former mentor, Ludwig von Mises, stormed out of a meeting.
In the middle of a debate on the distribution of income, in which you had people whom you would hardly call socialist or egalitarian, people like myself, Mises got up and said, "You're all a bunch of socialists," and walked right out of the room.
"You're all a bunch of socialists." Oh, that's amazing. I find it really interesting that such a free market person like Friedman is reputed to be would be having a conference on the distribution of income. I believe he had an idea for some sort of minimum guaranteed income or negative income tax, something like that. What was that, Bill?
Of course he would. This was the same man. This is in 1947, what you're talking about with Mount Pelerin. And what happened is 4 years previous in 1943 on the Council of Economic Advisors to Red DR, there's Milton Friedman who says, you know, we need a withholding tax, an income tax. And by the way, 1943 coincides with the highest marginal income tax rate that was ever existing in the United States at the time, which was 94%. Now, Friedman is touted as this capitalist vanguard, this guy who wrote a book called Freedom to Choose and things like that. I put him in the same category as the Keystone Keynesians because he assumes that if individuals have the levers of government at their disposal and rules at their disposal to cudgel others who don't obey them, that he can guide the United States through what they call the Chicago School monetarism to some kind of prosperity. It didn't turn out to be the case. I don't blame Mises one bit. As a matter of fact, Hayek was not the greatest friend of liberty, but because for the most part, Hayek had some very good foundational constructs about economics, but he was not an ANCAP. He was a minarchist. He was a limited government guy, which is pretty silly in my estimation as an abolitionist and as somebody who follows Mises and Rothbard. And I also want to put a plug in for a terrific pair of rap videos that were put out called Fear the Boom and Bust, a Hayek versus Keynes rap anthem, and Fight of the Century, Keynes versus Hayek Round 2, which is a great example of, as awful as Hayek was, Keynes was worse, and it's a way to popularize these economic notions for people who think that economics is truly a four-letter word. You know, I had when I went to Porkfest last week, Louis, I had the honor of being with Robert Anthony Peters, a good friend of mine, who's great in the Art and Liberty part of the movement. He and I went to Bretton Woods, which is near Rogers Campground where Porkfest was, so we could stand in front of the sign and go to the Gold Room in Bretton Woods where the crime of the century was committed in 1946 to form the International Monetary Fund. So my short answer is Mises was right to call them all socialists.
Yeah. Did you dust Bretton Woods for fingerprints and DNA and all that other stuff?
I did not, because they cover their tracks very well, as you know.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, from what I understand of Hayek, he was more of a social democrat.
Indeed, he was. And, you know, like so many people, he was a product of where he lived, how he grew up, and the instructors and teachers and professors he was exposed to and he was mentored by. Mises is a real outlier in this. Rothbard is a real outlier in these things. And I consider Rothbard to be the superior expositor of anarcho-capitalism and abolitionism to Mises. I found Mises brilliant, but Mises is really, really hard to get through if one attempted to read, for instance, Human Action.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely not something that you throw back a couple chapters and just absorb it, you know, like you would action novel.
It's not. You know, for this audience, we really do have to read a lot of books, and we tend to read a lot of books in this curious subculture that we're in, Lou. And if you don't want to read Human Action, I recommend Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State as the go-to one-stop shopping for finding out what does this peaceful framework for a world of voluntary cooperation, persuasion, and a stateless society look like. That's the place to go.
Anarcho-capitalism, if you can keep it, ma'am.
Indeed.
You know, it's funny about Porkfest because you have all these people that showed up to listen to economists and learn how to make yogurt and homemade shampoo.
And wear guns and not bathe.
I think for some people, the not bathing part was the water going out.
But remember, didn't Michael have some pet hippies while he was there?
No, those are my hippies.
Oh, those are your hippies. Okay.
And my hippies are clean hippies.
Okay. You can't be clean, by the way, if you have dreadlocks.
Clean-ish.
Clean-ish, yeah.
But going back to that video, it's really amazing that in an effort to stave off this idea of central planning, that they had to come up with a central plan to dispel central planning.
And they would, because you know what? Their imaginations were limited, except for Mises, of course, at the time. Their imaginations were so locked to statist solution sets as the only solution sets, they couldn't visualize. You know, it's like you and I visualizing interplanetary or intergalactic travel absent light, faster than light drives. I mean, it's for you and I right now, it's outside of our imaginary sphere to be able to accomplish that.
Yeah. Something else on Milton Friedman, there's a three-part video series about the Great Depression. And in, I believe it's the third episode, he calls John Maynard Keynes one of the greatest economic minds of the century or of all time.
It shocks me to no end, Lou, that he's used as this expositor of freedom and capitalism, and to a certain extent, anarcho-capitalism, and he's anything but. Now, mind you, his son, David Friedman, author of The Machinery of Freedom, and a brilliant expositor of anarcho-capitalism, he's the one who took Friedman's embryonic ideas, brought them to their logical conclusion, and he brilliantly speaks to that in both his books and his speeches he gives.
Yeah, I kind of look at Milton Friedman in the same way that I look at Ronald Reagan. His words were wonderful, but his actions, on the other hand, not so much.
And I look at Churchill the same way.
Yeah. We have a question from one of the listeners here, and basically what it comes down to is, if we reach LibPair and this horrible religion of the state dropped dead and went away, do you think that ANCAPs could live in harmony with anarcho-syndicalists, anarcho-communists? You know, they go off and do their own thing, and the ANCAPs do their own thing, and maybe they trade back and forth a little bit here and there. How do you see that working out?
You know, there's something I'd like your audience to look up, something called panarchy, just like it sounds, PANARCHY. And it speaks to that very thing. Can contiguous communities live who may live in just the opposite way? I would offer you this example of how that has worked for a peaceful society, and that would be the Amish and the Mennonites in North America. When you saw 400, 500 years ago when they started emigrating from religious persecution in Europe, and, well, 300 to 400 years ago, and they emigrated from Europe to North America and settled in Pennsylvania, for instance, the Amish have managed not only not to pay Social Security taxes, not only to not be tracked in the same fashion, not only to embrace this simple methodology of living in this whole sphere of living that encompasses everything they do, they've managed that pretty well without causing grief to others. As a matter of fact, they have benefited the society at large. They call everybody outside the Amish community, they refer to as the English monolithically. And for the most part, I've been surprised at how the government in the United States has ceded to some of these special requests that the Amish have made. So I would point to the Amish and Mennonites as an example, how two distinctly different communities in the way they live their lives, conduct their commercial and personal relationships, could live peacefully side by side. But I would also offer this cautionary note. One has to assume that a Swiss-style neutrality, a Swiss-style penchant for self-defense, and a Swiss-style interest in promoting their own self-interest to the point of defending themselves through the NAP, that would have to be embraced by ANCAPs in order to coexist with anarcho-communist syndicalists and any other variant in a philosophical milieu that somebody would adopt.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned religious persecution. I heard somebody say, I can't remember who it was for the life of me, but they said that the Puritans didn't come to America to escape religious persecution. They came here to be free to persecute.
And I agree with that. When you look at what happened with the original Puritans and the little communist enclaves that they created, which of course you and I would predict would fail, and they did fail, as history demonstrates, yes, I agree with that notion.
More Freedom Fiends coming up after this trip to the market.
Meow!
Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. final segment and redemption in the third act, we have a special Freedom Fiends bonus that you won't get anywhere else. If you go to freedomfiends.com and click the link that takes you to the blog, there is a audiobook torrent of Dobby Barker's Authoritarian Sociopathy. Dobby is one of our co-hosts here, and he is trying to put a project together, a study, to look into authoritarian sociopathy. And it bases kind of on the Milgram experiment. And have you read the book, or have you heard Dobby talk about this project, Bill?
I have indeed. It's not only the Milgram experiment, but it's also the Stanford experiment and a number of others that Dobby managed to study, like what was done by Joris Lammers out at Tilburg University and Adam Galinsky at the Kellogg School. I think he's, you know what, he may very well have here sort of like a lost ark hypothesis that if he could really flesh this thing out, it would show people that in a combination of Milgram, Stanford, and the Stockholm Syndrome, this kind of authoritarian sociopathy, this kind of psychopathy that's out there, it could be used as a powerful weapon against it.
Yeah. Yeah. I really think that people are brainwashed and they don't realize just exactly the yoke of slavery that they live under. And I personally believe that if more people saw it for what it really is, instead of this great benevolent benefactor and provider of roads, I think that people would have a much different opinion on it. And if we look at the lack of faith in the drug war, the loss of belief in the righteousness of it and the legitimacy of it, and a lot of people are turning away from it who were supporters not too long ago. And one of the stories that is helping to turn people comes to us from the Washington Post and author Radley Belko, who is also the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop. I believe that's the title of it.
Yeah, The Militarization of America's Police Forces.
Yeah. There's a guy, he's a 48-year-old terminal cancer patient, and he's on trial for growing marijuana that he used to treat his rare medical condition. And he was taken from the courthouse on Monday during his trial to the hospital. Now, here's what's really bad about this. He's not allowed to use his condition as part of his defense. And the closing paragraph in this is, so many at fault here. The prosecutor for cruelly bringing this case in the first place, the legislature for passing these laws, the judge for refusing to let the jury hear about McKenzie's condition, and of course there are the drug warriors in general who are willing to tolerate the occasional gunning down of a man in his home or imprisoning of a suffering lesion-covered cancer patient in order to demonstrate their opposition to getting high.
Their opposition to people altering their own consciousness and making certain vegetation illegal, and their lack of hesitancy to burn a baby alive in its crib with a flashbang grenade.
Yeah. Who would Jesus throw a flashbang grenade at? Which cancer patient would Jesus throw in jail? That's a question that needs to be asked.
Well, he wouldn't. We all know that. He wouldn't, because Jesus was a revolutionary. And Jesus, his most revolutionary comment was that, well, his most revolutionary contention was that you don't need anybody to bridge the gap between you and your God. That communication is direct.
Yep. And another person has changed sides in the war on drugs. And this is a former drug enforcement officer. I don't think he was DEA. I think he was local or state police. And it looks like his name is Barry Cooper. And from what they say in the article, and you can find this on the Free Thought Project, and I'll post these links into the show notes. This guy was like the top cop at Drug Bus, and he was taking stuff down left and right, you know, just, you know, a rock star of the drug warrior movement. And he has come out and said that a police should be abolished, or basically police should only leave the building when it comes time to investigate a crime, kind of like firemen are.
He doesn't go far enough. Abolish the state.
Exactly. Thanks for coming on tonight, Bill.
Thanks, Lou.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And go to freedomfiends.com for more Freedom Fiends. Worms.
Worms.